The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Thursday, March the 13th. My name's John Dennis, and this is Guardian Daily, the daily news podcast from The Guardian. Today, it's safe for you to return to Iraq. That's what the Home Office is preparing to tell hundreds of Iraqis who've had their applications for refugee status rejected by the UK. In his budget, Alistair Darling insists Britain is well prepared for the rocky economic conditions ahead.
I've made my choice. Responsible decisions, not irresponsible, unfunded promises. Fairness and opportunity for everyone in Britain to secure a strong and sustainable future, and I commend this budget to the House.
Also today, the inquest opens into the death of Manchester's top policeman. And the 21st century hermit is alive and well, and more likely to be living in a city with internet access than living in a cave.
I think caves are a bit out of fashion, hard to find as well. The study reveals that abandoned churches are quite popular, and there are more and more of those in Italy.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Sandy Waugh with a look at today's papers and the news headlines.
More than 1,400 rejected Iraqi asylum seekers are to be told they must go home or face being made homeless and losing financial support. This is according to leaked Home Office correspondence seen by The Guardian, which shows that the refugees will be given 3 weeks to decide. A full story later in Guardian Daily. The inquest opens this morning into the death of the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester, Michael Todd. He was found 2 days ago on the upper slopes of Snowdon. A post-mortem has found the cause of death is not immediately apparent. The Governor of New York State, Eliot Spitzer, has decided to resign after considerable pressure. Earlier in the week, he apologised for being caught up in a prostitution scandal. He'd been known as the Sheriff of Wall Street for his campaign against organised crime, business fraud and immorality. A protest by monks in Tibet against Chinese rule is spreading out of the country into China itself. There have also been marches of support around the world to mark the anniversary of an uprising against Chinese rule. On Monday, monks attempting to demonstrate in the Tibetan capital Lhasa was broken up by police with tear gas. Football, and both Tottenham and Everton were knocked out of the UEFA Cup last night. Both teams reached full-time drawn and went to extra time without a breakthrough. In penalty shootouts, Tottenham lost 6-5, Everton 4-2. Not much support for the Chancellor in today's papers. The Guardian calls him the hesitant debutant. The Mail, the man with rose-tinted glasses. The Sun warns us all not to drink or drive, and the Financial Times says that he's playing for time in the face of global turmoil. Otherwise, the most common story is the background of the dead police chief, with several papers claiming that he had secret lovers. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Iraq is a safe country to live in. That's what the Home Office is going to tell more than 1,400 rejected Iraqi asylum seekers. It says they must go home or live in destitution on the streets of Britain. Alan Travis, The Guardian's Home Affairs editor, has seen leaked Home Office correspondence.
They're going to be told that about 1,400 of them who've been in Britain for several years, at least before 2005, they're people whose asylum claims were rejected by the Home Office, but they haven't been sent back to Iraq, particularly southern and central Iraq, because the government's always considered it too unsafe to send them back. And therefore have kept them on what's called hard case support. This is very minimal welfare support, which is living in no-choice accommodation with vouchers for essential items, only utility bills paid, and in some cases three meals a day provided, but that's it. And what they're being told now is that the government has decided that it is safe to send them back to central and southern Iraq, and that unless they voluntarily return and sign up to go home, they will face losing all this basic support they have and indeed face the possibility of destitution.
Does the government give any explanations to why it considers these areas of Iraq now safe?
Well, that's a political question for Iraq. They've, since 2005, been sending forcibly returning people to northern Iraq, mainly Kurdish people, in routes to sending people back to a place called Erbil. The original ones were sent back wearing flak jackets. But as if to underline the government's attitude towards these people and whether Iraq is safe, they're asked to sign up to a voluntary repatriation deal, which includes a waiver. And that waiver says that that they must agree that they acknowledge that the International Organization on Migration, which is organizing the voluntary returns, has no responsibility for me or my dependents once I return to Iraqi territory. So effectively, they have to sign a waiver which says that they agree that the government and its agents will take no responsibility for what happens to them when they return to Iraq.
And what kinds of things had happened to these people when they left Iraq and caused them to leave Iraq and come to Britain?
Well, most of them came to Britain during the Iraqi war, and at the time of they were fleeing the invasion, or they were fleeing from before. Some of them date back to the time of Saddam Hussein, were fleeing from Ba'athist persecution. Since then, the chaotic nature of the country. Now, I've spoken to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. I spoke to them last night about the letter once it had been passed to me, and they said that their official advice was to governments was that it was not advisable to send people back to central and southern Iraq because it was impossible for the government to guarantee policing, law and order and judicial process. Which I find is alarming. You think that this government should act in that way. Also, I spoke to the Refugee Council last night, and they said Donna Covey, the chief executive, described the contents of the letter as a particularly shocking example of the government's policy of using destitution to starve people into leaving the country. So it's quite a sharp change of policy by the government, and one which will have reverberations.
Alan Travis, and there's more on that story at guardian.co.uk/refugees. Also on The Guardian's website today, over-by-over coverage of the second test in New Zealand, guardian.co.uk/sport. On the arts blog, Jonathan Jones on the Tate's turbine choice. The Tate Modern's new exhibit is predictably tasteful and restrained, blogs.guardian.co.uk/arts. And reinventing the pier, Robert Booth on plans for loft-style living in Weston-super-Mare, guardian.co.uk/UK. In Anglesey in North Wales, an inquest opens today into the death of Michael Todd, the Chief Constable of Manchester Police. Mr. Todd was found dead at the bottom of a cliff in Snowdonia in North Wales on Tuesday. The Guardian's Vikram Dodd says there are a lot of rumours about the cause of the death.
We know that Mike Todd went walking in Snowdon on Monday, and as the hours ticked by on Monday, concern grew amongst his colleagues and his friends about his state of mind. Sometime on Tuesday, a full-scale search started for him. They were trying to track the last known signal from his mobile phone using technology called CellSight. Eventually, his body was found on Tuesday afternoon, and he was found on a incline on about 100 metres from the peak of Snowdon, and he was found dead.
And there was the preliminary post-mortem yesterday, but there's no obvious cause of death.
There's no obvious signs of injury or how he came to meet his demise. What this does tell us is that very probably he did not throw himself off a clifftop, as some people reported. He did not slit his wrists. And what will happen today is that the coroner, Dewey Pritchard-Jones, has decided to set out a statement of preliminary findings. That's his plan anyway. To try and dispel some of the rumour that's going around. You know, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and speculation out there. The inquiry is in two parts, how he died, and then a further train of inquiry into what, if anything, drove him to take his own life. And at the moment, the probability amongst the police sources is that it was he did take his own life.
And it's not being treated as suspicious?
It's not being treated as suspicious at all. The big clue in that is that North Wales Police are handling that part of the inquiry are solely preparing a file for the coroner, not for the Crown Prosecution Service. Nobody else is being sought in connection with this. The pieces of the puzzle that point to him having a distressed state of mind are notes which were found away from the scene of Snowdon, and the most probable place was his flat in Manchester, and a series of phone messages from Mike Todd in his final hours, which is said to show him his distressed state of mind.
And it was an extremely difficult operation for the rescue services to actually retrieve the body from this remote mountainous area.
Yeah, Monday was a treacherous time on Snowdon. It took them several hours and many people to sort of recover his body and then bring it down the hillside. Conditions were very treacherous. There was snow and gales. One report, which was from the Press Association, had a source saying that he had consumed alcohol And that same source went on to say somebody on Snowden that evening would not have survived. You know, the assumption at the moment it was suicide. It is possible that he went up in a distressed state of mind and became overcome by conditions.
And there have been fulsome tributes to Mr. Todd's contribution to policing in this country. And his death has come as a shock, hasn't it?
He was one of the more macho, in-your-face police officers. So the prospect that he succumbed to a temporary imbalance in his mind, or as some people are speculating, had suffered long-term from a mental illness which led to this, you know, it's the obvious contradiction. You know, somebody appeared chirpy and had everything at his feet. He was, you know, on a good salary. He would have could have walked away from the job and had about £100,000 a year coming in and a big lump sum. You know, it's one of those classic things. You know, there wasn't a reason in the world to, you know, the casual observer as to why he would take his own life. You know, it's an issue. It'll be an issue that we talked about in the background in police and government circles about how, if it does turn out to be suicide, how somebody in a position such as his, which was a major force with its own counter-terrorism unit, didn't cope with the pressures of either his job or his personal life.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, 21st century hermits. Hackers raise questions about the security of the BBC's iPlayer software. And as racing at Cheltenham is cancelled because of the weather, some punters find other ways of having a flutter.
I've been out in worse weather.
Should there have been racing today?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Very disappointing. Really looking forward to the races, but unfortunately I won't get to see it this year, but hopefully next year. And to see the weather being so nice at the end of the day, you think, oh my God, why did it happen?
But first, Alistair Darling's first budget as Chancellor got mixed reviews. He downgraded his economic growth forecast and announced a raft of measures to combat climate change and child poverty. But in truth, he didn't have much opportunity to pull rabbits out of the hat. We produced a special podcast on the budget yesterday, which you can hear at guardian.co.uk/audio. One of my guests was our political columnist, Michael White.
Some of the reaction has been grudging, to say the least, damned with faint praise, and the small business people have said, well, at least he didn't spring any nasty surprises on us. Not much room for manoeuvre, either from what Gordon Brown has left him, bequeathed him, after 10 years as Chancellor. Mr. Darling is in the unfortunate position of not being able to complain about that, but also, of course, what's happening in the wider world, where this enormous storm in the financial markets spreading into the stock markets from the banking system is going, well, nobody knows how far. If you look at some of the numbers being estimated, they go up into trillions, and we're all a bit scared. So that also inhibits any freedom he has for action. He didn't really do much except tweak and come up with some constructive ideas and give a bit of ground to the non-doms here, and a rather more sums to child poverty there, and a bit for schools, and a bit for transport, and a bit for Greens. Never enough to satisfy the Greens. It was that sort of budget, really.
The budget was billed as Labour's greenest to date. There were measures to encourage householders and motorists to cut carbon emissions and to boost the use of biofuels. There was a tax on plastic bags. But Tony Juniper, director of Friends of the Earth, says it's not nearly enough.
This budget was being billed a few days ago as being the greenest ever, but I don't think anyone could claim that this is anything like the budget that we need in the face of challenges like global warming. The Chancellor had an enormous opportunity today with a seamless cross-party consensus on the need to take action to cut emissions. The opportunity was there to come forward with bold measures to help us all do our bit in our homes and in our workplaces and as we travel around the country in between home and work. And we've got very little, really, of what we could have had. We could have had a new scheme for grants and tax breaks to help us go green in the home. We could have had technology-forcing measures that would be bringing forward renewables much more quickly, things like feed-in tariffs, for example, whereby homeowners fitting small-scale renewables would get a good price for the power they're producing. We didn't really see any of that. We've got a few measures that are helpful, that are signalling the direction of travel that we're on. But the destination that the Chancellor set out today, a cut of 80% by mid-century, we will not reach that. Even if we are going in the right direction, we will not arrive at that destination with this modest level of ambition seen in the budget today.
Tony Juniper from Friends of the Earth. And there's full coverage of the budget, including our budget special podcast, at guardian.co.uk/budget.
Submissible.
for the viewer.
Yeah, we could have been killed.
A bit killed, yeah.
From now on, you'll never have to miss an unmissable moment. BBC iPlayer lets you watch programmes from the last 7 days on your computer. BBC iPlayer, making the unmissable unmissable.
Millions of internet users are able to breach the copyright of BBC television shows and download them onto their computers. Programme makers say the BBC's iPlayer, that's the software that lets internet users watch BBC TV programmes, isn't protecting their work. Bobby Johnson is The Guardian's technology correspondent. He spoke to Guardian Daily's Ben Green.
There's been a lot of argument about the BBC's iPlayer, which is their on-demand TV over the internet system. Lets you watch back programmes from the BBC at any time. But there are a lot of restrictions on it. So, for example, if you download a show, it's got a limited lifespan. If you go to the website, you can only watch it streaming on the website. So, a lot of geeks and hackers are kind of up in arms about this because they say they've paid their licence fee already. Anyway, what's happened is that last week the BBC announced that it created a new version of the website that was specifically for iPhones and iPods to look at. So you can surf to bbc.co.uk/iPlayer on your iPhone and you can watch videos, which you couldn't do before. In doing that, some rather clever guys have worked out that what they've actually done is opened up a stream of programmes completely unprotected with none of those expiry dates or anything attached to them. And if you know how, you can just simply go and download all the BBC programmes you like and keep them on your computer for as long as you want.
So I imagine this hasn't gone down too well at BBC Towers.
Well, it's an interesting one because they've said, look, this system is still in the test phase. We're not that worried about it. We'll find a way to work around it. On the other side, the hackers are all kind of jumping around with glee because they've finally got what they want. The other constituency here that are probably not best pleased are the TV producers themselves. They spent a very long time talking to the BBC and negotiating the idea of a rights deal for their shows. They saw the value in keeping those shows kind of limited so that they could then sell DVDs and things like that on the back of it. You know, this isn't the kind of move that's going to make them very happy. The BBC are really just keeping quite quiet about this. I think when they originally built this iPhone-based system, maybe they thought it wouldn't get picked up. They probably knew that the stream was going out to anyone who was looking, but they didn't think anyone would go and look. Actually, one of the hackers I spoke to said, as soon as he heard the announcement, he thought, aha, I think I can work around this. 12 minutes later, he was downloading all the programmes he wanted. You know, it's not a particularly difficult technical feat. All you do is get your computer to pretend to be an iPhone, basically. But it's one that the BBC looked like they didn't anticipate.
Bobby Johnson talking to Ben Green. And on Friday, you can hear more from the Changing Media Conference, where that was recorded, in this week's Media Talk podcast, guardian.co.uk/audio, where you can also hear this.
On this week's Tech Weekly podcast, we dig up the dirt on the grand poobah of the blogosphere. Nick Denton is the man who's transforming the American media. Over in the USA, Jemima talks to participatory media guru Henry Jenkins, gives us the skinny on the Facebook keynote, and walks us through the new video sharing sites contending for the YouTube throne. All this and more on Tech Weekly, available on Tuesdays at guardian.co.uk/audio.
It's supposed to be the second day of racing at Cheltenham today, only it'll actually be the first day, if they go ahead at all. That's because stormy weather meant yesterday's races had to be abandoned for the first time in 30 years. Prestbury Park was deemed unsafe for more than 55,000 punters who had to find alternative means of entertainment and other ways of disposing of their stake money, as The Guardian's Stephen Morris reports.
A day out at the Cheltenham Festival ruined. The racing was cancelled and 55,000 disappointed people, including a huge Irish contingent, have got nowhere to go. What do? Well, a good few of them seem to have found their way here, to the O'Neill's pub. This is the Montpellier area of Cheltenham. It's usually quite a quiet, genteel sort of place. Not tonight.
Well, it's not too bad, like, but I've been out in worse weather.
You're disappointed the racing hasn't gone on today?
It's been up and down. It's a bit like the wind, it just comes and goes.
Should there have been racing today?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. But at the end of the day, health and safety had to come in first, so they had to.
How many pints have you had today, sir?
One.
One pint today?
Yeah, oh, she's drinking this all day. It's great stuff altogether. Like.
Hello, Emma. How's your day been?
Very disappointing. Really looking forward to the races, but we come out in Cheltenham to see what the atmosphere will be like, and everyone's keeping their heads up and having a good time, and the band's great. And
drinking wine. How very civilised. But you're back to the racing tomorrow, are you?
Everyone else is, unfortunately. All my friends have got to go back to work, so no, unfortunately I won't get to see it this year, but hopefully next year. And to see the weather being so nice at the end of the day, you think, oh my God, why did it happen?
A bit of ability. There's Borodale running in track two.
More than half £1 billion is bet on the Cheltenham Festival. So even though the racing's off for today, Ladbrokes in the town centre is still bustling. People are placing bets on horse racing from other parts of the country, but also on computer-generated greyhound races and even a computerised toss of the coin.
Do you know who that was?
Kirsten, yes.
So, no racing at Cheltenham today, but your shop is still pretty busy.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Cheltenham is obviously full of racegoers at the moment. There's immense disappointment amongst all the customers, but it's very much the show goes on. And, you know, they're all here. There's plenty of other action for them to get stuck into. It's racing at Huntingdon and Southall today. We've got greyhound racing, and, yeah, so there's something, you know, there for them still. So
I see the greyhound racing is virtual greyhound racing. I've never seen that before.
It is, yeah. It's a relatively new product. We've had virtual racing probably 3 to 4 years now. It's still in its infancy, really, but it's actually getting quite popular. You know, it's basically computer-generated images. But yeah, customers seem to accept it, and even some of your hardened customers, the hardened gamblers, they actually have really got into it. Those who we thought never would actually. So.
And I see people betting on the toss of a coin as well on those screens.
Yeah, very much. So there's people who are betting on anything, of course. And then, of course, you know, just go back to the virtual. You know, it is weatherproof. You know, the gales won't run all that. But yes, there's something for everyone there.
The more imaginative have shunned the betting shop and even the pubs, though. Rob Churches and his mates have spent their stake money usefully. They bought hats for a silly hat competition.
Yeah, some stupid game that they thought up that we got to play while we're playing bowling, so it's just to entertain ourselves.
What sort of hat's that you've got?
I call it a designer wedding outfit, really, wedding hat from the Salvation Army. Reduced £15 down to £7, I thought it was a bargain.
Well, we've got a hunting hat here, I see, and I saw your mate has got a swimming hat as well.
Yeah, I think he's restricting the blood to his head, but he's had problems with that for quite a while.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Hermits are making a comeback, according to academics at Bologna University in Italy. They're not wearing long, unkempt beards. Most of them are women. And they don't sit cross-legged in caves either, or squat on mountaintops. Tom Kington is The Guardian's correspondent in Rome.
It's a new study that has been undertaken by a sociologist at the University of Bologna, which has discovered that there's something of a revival of the hermit life in Italy. There are a number of people who are ducking out of the modern world and going to live in a state of seclusion and getting on with a fairly strict regime of prayer and penitence.
And, I mean, hermits are something you associate with the Dark Ages. Why are they making a comeback now?
Well, yes, I mean, hermits were spread across Europe in the Dark Ages and then began to dwindle through the centuries and were pretty much extinct in the 20th century before undergoing a bit of a revival in the 1960s. Before the Vatican, then, in 1983, recognised hermits officially once again, and today you can go to your local bishop and get a licence.
Why do modern-day 21st century hermits want to cut themselves off from the world?
I think it reflects, to a certain extent, a kind of back-to-basics mood amongst Catholics. Certainly Pope Benedict subscribes to this. He's becoming known as pretty much a conservative pope who isn't too worried about spreading the faith widely, but just concentrating on the core faithful. And I think that hermits would perhaps see themselves as the core of the core.
Where do they live?
Well, I think caves are a bit out of fashion, hard to find as well. The study reveals that abandoned churches are quite popular, and there are more and more of those in Italy as churchgoers are falling in number. But there's nothing to stop you just sitting in your own flat in the middle of Rome or Turin or Milan and getting on with your hermit life there.
So you can be a hermit in the city.
Yeah, and there are really no restrictions on going out doing your shopping. As long as you stick to your prayer regime and restrict, as the researcher told me, restrict your communication with others to spiritual dialogue.
But some of them have the internet. I mean, that's cheating a bit, isn't it?
Well, as he said, as long as you use the internet in the same way that you would communicate with others, i.e. for spiritual purposes, and perhaps don't muck around too much on YouTube.
And there's even a website for hermits.
That's an American website which seems to be flourishing and offers all kinds of tips on how to get on with your hermit lifestyle and whether the do's and don'ts. There's an article up there on how and why hermits should work, and also a bulletin board where hermits can swap tips on going about their life.
Tom, many thanks. The producers of this edition of Guardian Daily were Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.